The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Well, everything is slightly worse than yesterday. Saw that in a tweet just a moment ago, and that pretty much explains it. Almost every day just gets a little bit worse, although in waking up this morning, you look at some of the headlines like on the Drudge Report, and you would have thought we were in an all-out hot war. And so the team's been reading and examining some of the headlines and the news stories as they've come in. And it paints a very different picture. Of course, we'll have some clips of some of the media, the Democrat media complex that is hoping for hot war. They're hoping for violence. They're hoping for anything that will boost their ratings and that will hurt Donald Trump. But you start digging into some of the details of this story. And by the way, we've got an article at thetrumpet.com. Brent Noctegal has been busy this week. He's got one up there titled, Iran's Face-Saving Missile Strike Against U.S. Bases. They didn't even go after the base that has the most U.S. personnel. This was a face-saving attack, if you can even call it an attack. I told Sam earlier today that I think the mullahs were pretty much hoping and praying that those missiles would not kill any Americans. These were precision-guided missiles, and they went exactly where the Americans were not sleeping. And yet, like Brent brings out in his article, it does give the mullahs an opportunity to say, well, there you go. What do they title this? The New York Times had it in their piece, calling it fierce revenge. This is fierce revenge, this attack on the two bases. I think 22 missiles. The fierce revenge by the Revolutionary Guards has begun, they said. But it was late last night when President Trump, we understand well his red line. We've been talking about that over the past week. If you kill Americans, that's what will trigger a response, a retaliation. But the president tweeted out last night, all is well. Missiles launched from Iran at two military bases located in Iraq. I mean, it is significant that the firing of these missiles came from Iran. That's a first, for sure. But the president went on to say, assessment of casualties and damages taking place now. So far, so good. We have the most powerful and well-equipped military anywhere in the world. And then you compare that with what Mohammad Zarif tweeted out. This is Iran's foreign minister. And he said, Iran took and concluded proportionate measures in self-defense. We do not seek escalation or war, but will defend ourselves against any aggression. So that's the Iranian foreign minister saying, basically, look, we were entitled to take this action because of the attack we came under last week, and we're not seeking to escalate this, or we're not interested in going to war. And I think you can't believe very much of what the propaganda chief says, but I think you can believe him on this. I don't think they want to go at it with the United States, not here and now. Notice what the White House, this is a Fox News White House correspondent, what he said last night. Again, even in the early stages of this missile strike, this is John Roberts, clip 5.
There is a belief among some high-ranking administration officials that what we saw from Iran here tonight may have been an intentional miss. that they knew where the U.S. forces were housed, and even though they hit the Al Asad air base with 10 missiles and hit the base in Erbil with one, that those missiles fell far away from where U.S. forces were being housed. And while there may have been some casualties among Iraqi forces, there were no casualties among American forces, which really would have changed the equation. So this is being potentially seen here, and this is still in the early going, as a potential face-saving measure on the part of Iran to say, we did something here, but they didn't do enough that would invoke a really harsh and wide-ranging retaliatory response from the United States.
So it was a very careful strike, a face-saving. He even used that same term that Brent has in his headline. A face-saving measure that allows for them to brag at home. And they were right away. I think the initial reports coming out of Iran, the state-run media, is that something like 80 Americans were killed. No truth to this. But right away, they were saying, oh, this was devastating. Fierce revenge has begun. But the foreign minister was very quick to tweet out, we seek no escalation or we don't want war with the United States. That was John Roberts at Fox News. Here's another prominent Iraqi analyst, Michael Prigent. He said this on the BBC this morning, clip six.
They had to have the launch come from Iran to symbolize that it's a response to Qasem Soleimani's death. But they used precision-guided ballistic missiles in order to miss the American side of these Iraqi bases. The bad part of it is they actually injured Iraqis. But these 15 ballistic missiles that were launched without killing or injuring an American, and also the language sent to the United States that, you know, this is our proportionate attack. If you respond, we'll hit your allies in the region, and we may conduct attacks inside the United States. This is the de-escalation.
This, he says, is the de-escalation. Quite unlike what you heard on the cable news channels last night, except for Fox News. But this signaled a de-escalation in the crisis. Because they used, as he said there, the precision-guided missiles in order to miss the U.S. troops. They did not want to. They've seen what happens when you kill one American contractor. They've seen how the United States now, under President Trump, retaliates or responds to that. They don't want that to happen again. And so you have these 20 missiles fired off in the middle of the night, and then that was that. And the tweets and so on. It really, and then you wake up this morning to this tragic plane crash, this Ukrainian airliner that was taking off from Tehran, and it just exploded in the air. And of course, that gives rise to all kinds of speculation on social media. I don't think it's been the best morning for the mullahs. But you see the propaganda, you read the propaganda, and then you To see it on state-run media in Tehran is one thing, but to see how excited the Democrat media complex was last night at the prospect of hot war. This is Steve Schmidt on MSNBC, clip seven.
And we're at the early stages of a hot war. It is a monumental moment that the Iranian military has launched a ballistic missile attack against U.S. military personnel on Iraqi bases in Iraq. It is almost certain that there will be a response from the United States.
Well, we'll see. Of course, anything can happen. But to get the context that you need, prophetically, you can go back and listen to yesterday's program about U.S. isolationism. We know where the United States is headed. Ultimately, it's headed out of Iraq. But in the short run here, it has established, it has reestablished some deterrence. Clearly. You'd never know it, though, in listening to or watching CNN, MSNBC. One more comment here from Steve Schmidt, clip eight.
We've entered into a hot war with Iran. American personnel are under attack by Iranian ballistic missiles right now, as we speak. This has been wrought by the judgment of a president who was very clear over the course of the campaign that he knows more than all of the generals. We have seen the diplomatic corps of the United States utterly gutted over the last 3 years.
So it's all President Trump's fault. He's unhinged. He has no plan. Nothing's working. The New York Times this morning, it says, Iran's firing of ballistic missiles from inside its borders, not relying on rockets from Iranian-backed proxies, at two of the main military bases where many of more than 5,000 American troops in Iraq are stationed, was a significant escalation. That's the word for the day, escalation. We'll use the word de-escalation in our title. But this is a significant escalation. It is, I don't want to say it's not significant, the fact that they fired ballistic missiles from their own nation. Typically they do. They hide behind their proxies. They hide behind Hezbollah or Hamas or all these Iranian militias in Iraq. But these missiles came straight from Iran. And as that one commentator said, it had to be that way for them to save face. We'll see what happens. We'll see if Mr. Schmidt is right or not as to whether this is the beginning of a hot war. I played that clip for you yesterday, by the way. My father, I have it here again today. We'll play it in just a bit. Just to keep our minds constantly on the big prophetic overview. That's what we need to keep coming back to. Anyway, it talks here about the significant escalation. And it says here in the New York Times, it was a stark message from Tehran that it has the will and the ability to strike at American targets in neighboring Iraq. Look at, now they have a plan. This was a stark message that they've got the ability, that they've got the will, that they can carry out a plan. Now Donald Trump, no plans. It's nothing. He knows more than the generals. He just operates on a whim. There's no rhyme or reason to anything that he does. Look at how they talk about the Iranian strategy. Iran's backpedaling, as I said yesterday. They're not. I mean, they've been shaken by this strike last week. Their general, we'll talk more about him in a second. The Times says Iranian news media reported the attacks hours after remains of General Soleimani were returned to his hometown in Iran for burial amid a huge outpouring of grief and rage at the United States. It says the funeral processions, this statement stood out to me too. The funeral procession was so huge and unwieldy that more than 50 people died in a stampede. So the 50, I think it was 56 total. 56 people died or were stampeded to death at a funeral. This is very unusual to me. All that we have to go on here is what the state media is reporting. And in some cases, the Democrat media complex is quite happy to take the propaganda and run with it. But there are some people that would like to know a little bit more about this, the plane crash this morning. There's some things that aren't going so well for the mullahs. Speaking of the funeral procession, NBC had a live feed of Soleimani's funeral yesterday. And they were, judging by the two commentators, it was powerful. It was riveting. The outpouring of response towards Soleimani, his remains, in his hometown. When have you ever seen this kind of coverage? This is a man, as you well know, he's got blood all over his hands. He's killed American soldiers. How much did MSNBC or NBC, how much did they cover the funerals for the soldiers that this man killed? Or the tens of thousands of others throughout the Middle East? And yet, there they are, just heaping praise on this man. It's disgraceful. Listen to this from NBC last night, clip one.
Qasem Soleimani's burial happening right now in his hometown in Iran. Cal Perry joins us now from Doha. And Cal, what do you know about his burial tonight?
Yeah, you know, he's being buried as we speak, and it's happening actually next to his radio operator from the Iran-Iraq war, something he requested. And it gives you a little insight into the kind of hero that this man was in Iran. A million people died in the war between Iran and Iraq in the 80s, and so the Quds Force, and so General Soleimani became the way for the Iranian military to fight its enemies abroad and not in Iran. And that really was their ethos, the principle. That's why you see Hezbollah along the border with Israel. And you saw that war in 2006, the idea of fight Israel in Lebanon and not Iran. In 2003, when the U.S. invaded Iraq, Qasem Soleimani was engaged in killing U.S. soldiers. The idea there, fight the U.S. In Iraq and not Iran. It really speaks to why he was such a hero in Iran.
Why he was such a hero in Iran. He kept war out of their home country, using all these proxies instead, abroad. That's the kind of coverage we've been getting over the last week. Time magazine had a story yesterday. It was in Time for Kids, I believe. The kids' version of Time, where they told parents, if your children are having questions, if they're asking about Soleimani, well, here's a little fact sheet that we've prepared. Who was Qasem Soleimani? Time says, to the children, Soleimani was a top military leader in Iran, a country in the Middle East. And that's it. That's it. He was just a top military leader. The people of Iran see him as a hero. All of them do. Every single one. Why did the U.S. take action against Soleimani? Time says, well, President Donald Trump has called Soleimani a terrorist. President Trump has called him that. Nothing there about how that all U.S. officials for the past 20 years have called him a terrorist. The nation, the number one state sponsor of terrorism. And then this, like I said the other day, this was the kingpin. And here they are on NBC providing all of this live coverage. And people, I guess, don't think anything of it. Just the whole tone of the back and forth between the female host and then the other man reporting. Here's a bit more, clip two.
It is very telling that in his death, he was able to sort of rally Iranians together. This was a country just a few weeks ago where we saw mass protests against the government. And what we see tonight happening in his hometown is a rallying cry in support of the Iranian government, Allison.
Cal, it's amazing as we're just watching these images of all the people out there. You can hear what sound to me like prayers, and you could just see the throngs of people, and their eyes are absolutely glued on what's happening. You just get the sense of how important this is to the people there. And you can see what it looks like. They are moving his body right now. It is just an absolutely incredible thing to be witnessing.
It's just incredible. Their eyes are glued to this scene. The people, the prayers. What an incredible event to witness. Well, this, like so many other things that the radical left has been doing in recent years, you can see why it backfires. The things they say on the nightly cable stations, the attacks going after Donald Trump or whoever, and this kind of coverage. How does this kind of coverage set with the American people that are at home watching? Conrad Black at American Greatness, he said the Democrats have stumbled into yet another bear trap in their unanimous objection to President Trump's order to kill the world's leading terrorist, Qasem Soleimani. Their unanimous rejection or objection to it. And now, as if that's not bad enough, they then try to make this man into a hero. It's just disgraceful. It says the same misdirected solicitude that caused the Washington Post to describe ISIS leader Baghdadi, after he was driven to suicide by U.S. special operators, as an austere cleric, has elevated Soleimani to the status of an Iranian General MacArthur. This is Conrad Black. The Iranian General MacArthur. It's shocking and disgraceful that the Democratic leadership and candidates have swarmed like the Gadarene swine to support Tehran's side of this issue. They're just quite happy to swallow Iranian propaganda and then regurgitate it on out to the rest of the American people. They trust Iran's state media more than they trust the Trump administration. They believe, they're not going to say this out front, but they believe in their heart of hearts that there's more truth coming from the Ayatollah. They even drew a lot of attention to his tears this week. The tears of the Ayatollah. The poetry of Soleimani. Oh, yes. They think, in their heart of hearts, they think there's more truth springing from the leaders in this radical regime, this terrorist sponsoring nation, than there is coming from the White House. It says something about where we are in the United States. One more exchange here. Actually, I've got two more, but listen to this one from that same NBC report last night, clip three.
It's an incredibly powerful moment for the country and, frankly, for the region. And these crowds that we've seen in the past few days in Tehran and even in Iraq really speaks, I think, to the moment that this is that you're sort of referencing. Iran is a country that is rallying tonight around a war hero and rallying around somebody who was more than a military leader. He was an icon. You know, when you look at those protests that started a week ago outside the U.S. Embassy, it was his name that protesters were putting on the wall saying he is our leader.
If you look at the protests around the embassy last week, it was his name that they put on the wall. What about those protests surrounding the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad? All of these Iranian militia members, hundreds of them, storming into the green zone. They didn't have any security clearance for that. They just marched right on in, chanting death to America. Oh, yes, that was all going on well before, days before Soleimani was killed. Death to America, of course, that's been going on for decades. But the media's never been concerned about that until after Soleimani was killed. And then they drew attention to the fact that, hey, they're out there chanting death to America now, as if that started last Friday. But here come these militia members storming the embassy, throwing objects, setting things on fire, breaking windows. This is on the U.S. embassy grounds. This is not a protest outside the embassy. They were raising their militia flags, and then they did paint Soleimani's our leader. They put that on one of the walls. They set fire to the guard posts. They set fire to the embassy walls that would burn. And you know how the United States responded. President Trump had to send in, I think, about 100 Marines to just quell the violence. And so here was our embassy for 48 hours under siege. And it's described in that report last night as if, hey, these were protesters. They just were passionate. And they even painted Soleimani on the wall because they revered him. He's their hero. One final clip from that NBC report, clip four.
There have been delegations, as you sort of look at these pictures, from mm-hmm. around the region, from Iran's proxies coming into Iran to pay their respects. And this is also, I think, why we saw the Ayatollah Khomeini tearing up and his voice quivering as he spoke to those crowds in Tehran. It's an incredibly emotional moment for the country, and it's not lost on this region. People from all over the region flowing into Iran to witness what is truly a historical moment, Allison.
people from all over the region flowing into Iran to see this man's funeral. That's what NBC is reporting. Delegations from across the region showing up to pay their respects for Qasem Soleimani, the mass murderer. And the Ayatollah, for his part, he was quivering when he was crying over the casket. The New York Times, going back to the story that's in the front page of the Times today, you have to go deep within the story to actually find that, oh, maybe this wasn't an escalation. Maybe this was more of a de-escalation, this missile strike last night. The Times says two people close to the Revolutionary Guard said that if the United States did not strike, Iran would also de-escalate. But if the United States did attack, then Iran was preparing for at least a limited conflict. So even if President Trump responds today or whenever, they're prepared for something limited. That's what last night was. It was very limited. It wasn't aimed at the biggest base. It wasn't aimed at the embassy. These were precision-guided missiles, and they carefully avoided where the U.S. troops were sleeping. It says in this same article, over the past 2 days, American military and intelligence officials had closely monitored the movements of Iran's ballistic force units, the crown jewel of the country's arsenal. So they struck the United States or U.S. targets with the crown jewel of their country's arsenal, and they didn't kill anybody. Or maybe if they did, they were Iraqi citizens. I guess we'll find out as the day unfolds. But the crown jewel of the country, here they've got all these proxies, Hamas firing rockets at will, and of course those aren't that accurate either, and they're much smaller. Hezbollah with all of its rockets aimed at Israel. And yet the mothership can't steer a ballistic missile to actually cause some damage that would really make the United States hurt or experience some pain. This was not a statement coming from a nation that is ready for all-out war. This was a de-escalation. It says, finally, the Iranian missile attack came on a day that began with thousands of Iranians taking to the streets. Well, it talks about the funeral procession and then the 56 people who were stampeded to death. In Brent's article, Iran's face-saving missile strike against U.S. bases, he refers to this article, I think two articles, from Lee Smith. Brent talks about the fact that this is a de-escalation, that the U.S. has reestablished, at least temporarily, some deterrence. But in the bigger picture, he points you to Lee Smith's piece, how Iran and America are suddenly both naked. And he explains what he means by that. It says, in making Iran accountable, Trump has knocked Iran down to its natural size and likely made Americans safer from Iranian aggression than they have in fact been at any point in the last 40 years, during which Iranian proxies have repeatedly killed large numbers of Americans. It's just happened over, and it started with the embassy, the hostage crisis in 1979, but then it continued with the attacks in Beirut in the early 1980s. It's just gone on for 40 years. And in each case, Iran's been able to hide behind their proxies. As Smith explains in his article, they've always had the position of plausible deniability. They could say, well, you know, we weren't directly involved in that particular one. Well, killing Soleimani, as Lee Smith brings out, this exposed that lie. It says here, the policy of appeasement that began in 1979 with the embassy takeover culminated in the 2015 JCPOA under the Obama administration, flooded Soleimani's war chests with hundreds of billions of dollars and legitimized Iran's right to a large-scale nuclear weapons program. It says, in line with the decades-long U.S. policy of augmenting the Iranian threat in order to avoid taking action against it, Obama said the only alternative to giving Iran the bomb was war. So we've got to let them build up their arsenal. If we try to stop it, it's just going to lead to conflict. It's going to lead to violence. It's going to start a war. Listen to Lee Smith. It says, Donald Trump was vilified when he exited the Iran deal in May, but in the eyes of, this is important here, but in the eyes of the foreign policy establishment, he committed an even graver sin by exposing the 40-year-old lie that U.S. policymakers, right and left, had cultivated to rationalize their collective unwillingness to protect Americans from Iranian terror. The lie that he's talking about there is their ability to hide behind their proxies. The fact that they always had this plausible deniability, and that every time they lashed out, there might be a U.S. response in some form or fashion, but it never ever went direct to Iran until last week when they took out this so-called revered general, this hero, as we keep hearing in the press. Smith says, Trump's trashing of the old rulebook has stripped Iran of the most important instruments, one of the most important instruments in its arsenal, plausible deniability. You see how that this is a change in direction for the United States. Here's a president who's trashed the old rulebook, and he's going forward with a different approach. Listen to his Secretary of State yesterday. This is Mike Pompeo, clip 10.
And we could see clearly that not only had Soleimani done all of the things that we have recounted, right, hundreds of thousands, a massacre in Syria, enormous destruction of countries like Lebanon and Iraq, where they've denied them sovereignty, and the Iranians have really denied people in those two countries what it is they want, right? Sovereignty, independence, and freedom. This is all Soleimani's handiwork. And then we'd watch as he was continuing the terror campaign in the region. We know what happened at the end of last year in December, ultimately leading to the death of an American. So if you're looking for imminence, you need to look no further than the days that led up to the strike that was taken against Soleimani. And then you, in addition to that, have what we could clearly see were continuing efforts on behalf of this terrorist to build out a network of campaign activities that were going to lead potentially to the death of many more Americans. It's the right decision. We got it right. The Department of Defense did excellent work, and the president had a entirely legal, appropriate, and a basis, as well as a decision that fit perfectly within our strategy and how to counter the threat of malign activity from Iran more broadly.
That's U.S. policy there, which is clearly stating that there's a direct connection. He's the one who's operating all of these areas. Syria, the massacres in Syria, Lebanon, Iraq. It's all Soleimani's handiwork. And this is Iran's top general. This is Iran. And, of course, you want to focus in on the difference in the two administrations. Look at the way President Obama and John Kerry treated these individuals. Soleimani, Zarif, the propaganda minister. They respected and even admired their Iranian counterparts. They believed them. This is all Soleimani's handiwork, these disastrous areas. Lebanon, Iraq, Syria. What a difference. What a change in direction. Listen to one more statement here. There's a question before. This is a reporter, again, bringing up something that's straight out of the Iranian propaganda playbook. And then you'll hear Secretary Pompeo's response, clip 11.
Iran's Foreign Affairs Minister Zarif granted an interview saying that Soleimani was on a diplomatic visit to Iraq. That the U.S. strike to take him out was state terrorism, that President Trump has prepared to commit war crimes, and that Iranians are enraged. First, that's the first question. I'd like your reaction to that.
So, let's see. So, Zarif's statement. His first statement that is Soleimani was traveling to Baghdad on a diplomatic mission. Anybody here believe that? Is there any history that would indicate that it was remotely possible that this kind gentleman, this diplomat of great order, Qasem Soleimani, had traveled to Baghdad for the idea of conducting a peace mission? I made you reporters laugh this morning. That's fantastic. We know that wasn't true. We not only know the history, we know in that moment that was not true. Zarif is a propagandist of the First Order, and most of what you suggested in his text message or email or message that you laid out there was indeed Iranian propaganda. It's not new. We've heard these same lies before. It's fundamentally false. He was not there on a diplomatic mission trying to resolve a problem.
That's the Secretary of State saying about Zarif that he's a propagandist of the First Order. Zarif and John Kerry, best friends. These were best friends traveling the world to try to finalize the JCPOA. And there's Secretary Pompeo answering that reporter's question. Are you serious? You seriously think Soleimani was in Baghdad on a diplomatic mission? You seriously think that he was going there on a peacekeeping mission? His people just attacked the U.S. Embassy. It's a different direction the United States is heading in now, but it's also one that, like Obama wanted, it's one that's probably going to result in a hasty departure from the nation of Iraq. The departure of U.S. troops, that is. Lee Smith, writing at the New York Post, this is the same one, a different article. But he says, now that Trump has brought down the Islamic Republic's top military commander and terror mastermind, he can reconcile the two wings of the party by declaring mission accomplished and dropping the mic. America's work here is done. He says it shouldn't be a hard decision to make. He says, finally, America doesn't need to be in Iraq to advance and maintain its Mideast interests. So it's a very similar position to Victor Davis Hanson, which we read through his yesterday. These are conservatives. These are Trump supporters. These are individuals saying, look, can't we accomplish what we need to in the Middle East without being in Iraq? In other words, can't we accomplish what we need to and just hand it over officially to Iran? Well, Lee Smith talks about some of the other assets that we have in the region, other bases and so on, and we've got an ally in Israel. We've got Arab allies. But those are all things that can change in a hurry. He says, in taking down Soleimani, Trump carved out his own exit strategy. It would be a pity to squander the historic triumph he earned last week. Soleimani's killing lets us get out of the Iraqi quagmire on a high note. So there is an element or a restoration of deterrence to some degree. But it's the same course of getting out of the quagmire, like you heard on that clip from Sean Hannity yesterday. Why should we let the swamp creatures send our boys, America's finest, off to some foreign battlefield? And then we abandon them. Why go through this? We're entering into a new age of warfare, after all, where everything is just a push of a button, that's all. How's that going to work out for the United States? How's it worked out historically when we've just isolated ourselves? Again, for the bigger picture, in this program from 2019, the German whirlwind conquers Iran. My father talks here. The subject here in this quote, this clip you're about to hear, is Iran and how that they're not going to go to war with the United States, but there will be a war involving Iran, a massive one at that. Your Bible prophesies of this. and it tells you who the war will be against. Here's my father from 2019, just a few months ago, clip 9.
Well, I can tell you from Bible prophecy that they're not going to have a war with America, they're not going to have a war with Britain, and they're not going to have a war with even the Jewish state, which is very close to them, or the country of called Israel today. But that there is a nation that is going to, or a military power that's going to come against them with a military whirlwind, according to Bible prophecy. And it's going to overwhelm them, and they're going to actually trigger World War III.
That's the Daniel 11:40 clash between the King of the South, that's radical Islam headed by Iran, and the King of the North, which is the European beast power headed by Germany. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Herbert W. Armstrong long forecast the arrival of a military superpower in Europe. In a world where European nations can't rely on the United States, one in which they fear Russia and face the constant threat of radical terror, their only hope of survival is to band together. This is what we see happening, and what we see happening was prophesied in your Bible. Request Germany and the Holy Roman Empire to learn about the history of Germany and the Holy Roman Empire and to understand where the events in Europe today are leading. 3,000 years ago, the prophet Daniel explained that at the time of the end, radical Islam would push against Europe. That time is now. We are witnessing the first manifestations of this Islamist push against Europe, and it's leading to a spectacular clash between these two prophesied kings, the King of the North and the King of the South. What does the Bible say about the identity of these two kings? What about the end time? Will everyone be affected by these events? Request our two booklets, The King of the South and Germany and the Holy Roman Empire. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Fleury.
On yesterday's program, we talked about the plague of the human heart. Jeremiah 17:9 saying that the heart is deceitful above all things. It's desperately wicked. Who can know it? God has to show us. God has to lead the way for a miraculous transformation to happen. And of course, we need his spirit. We need his law to understand the right way to think and to behave. 1 John 3 and verse 4 says, "Whosoever commits sin transgresses also the law, for sin is the transgression of the law." That's how the Bible defines sin. When we transgress God's law, it is sin. Sin, in other words, is thinking and doing what God says is wrong, not what human beings say. But what does God have to say about it? Proverbs 16, I took you through several verses from this chapter on yesterday's show as well. And we'll just go and look at a few more, because it says a lot in this chapter about the heart and how that we think of ourselves, or how we think of ourselves, that we have all of these pure motives. And of course, one of the key verses in that chapter is that there's a way that seems right to a man, but the end thereof are the ways of death. It might seem right, and that's what most people conclude. When you talk to them about right and wrong, they think it's their conscience that tells them what sin is. or what it isn't. We were talking in our scrum meeting this morning about all that. You see these reports of crime in cities on the west coast of the U.S., like in San Francisco and elsewhere, where the law of God is, or rather the laws of the land, certainly not the law of God either, but the laws of the land, they're not enforced. And so you have all of this rampant crime. And then Richard was pointing out here in the U.K., crime's on the increase in London, and yet the authorities, they say they don't have time for the petty crimes, but they do have time to knock on someone's door that might have sent out an offensive tweet or a tweet that wasn't sensitive enough to a minority, a group, transgenders, whatever it might be. It's just such a twisted and warped set of priorities. It shows what happens when we kick God out. And every man's left to do what seems right in his own eyes. That's Judges 21:25. That's what we're seeing. People who just conclude that, well, it's my conscience that tells me what's right and wrong. In other words, I decide. It's what I think. There's no guide. There's no absolute. It's a different standard for everyone. Proverbs 16. Again, verse 25, there's a way that seems right to a man, but the end thereof are the ways of death. It ends in death. If we don't stick to that perfect law of liberty, as it says in James 1, then we're going to end up far off course. We're going to end up in darkness. If we don't look to God and His commandments, we're not going to understand what's right and what's wrong. I went through those verses in Jeremiah 10 yesterday about God guiding and directing our steps. We need Him. We need His correction. We need His judgment. We need His law. We need to study God's Word and study it for correction, for reproof, like it says in 2 Timothy 3. I'll just read a couple verses here in Isaiah 45. We'll come back to Proverbs 16 if you're reading along with me. But Isaiah 45 and verse 9, it says, "Woe unto him that strives with his maker. Let the potsherd strive with the potsherds of the earth. Shall the clay say to him that fashions it, what make you? Or your work, he has no hands?" The Revised Standard says on that last part, your work has no handles. That's like a pot turning around and telling the potter, what are you doing? You don't know what you're doing. You've made a mess of this. That's what man has done with God. They want God to just keep out of their business. They want to carry on and do things their way. That's been man's history. Verse 10, it says, "Woe unto him that says unto his father, what beget you? Or to the woman, what have you brought forth?" It's like a little infant coming out and then turning around to the parents and saying, "What are you doing? You don't know what you're doing." Verse 11 in the Revised Standard, it says, "Thus says the Eternal, the Holy One of Israel and His Maker, will you question me about my children or command me concerning the work of my hands?" Are you, God's response is, are you really going to question me? Are you really going to argue with me? I'm the maker. I brought all of you into existence. I was reading a little bit last night from Andrew Roberts' book on Winston Churchill. He witnessed so much carnage and violence and death even. He was on the front lines there. In 1915, 1916, after the Dardanelles disaster, it wasn't his fault, but he resigned and went right to the front lines. Here he's seeing all these youths. He was in his 40s at the time. All these young Brits just being slaughtered in the trenches. And it made him think about just the utter futility of human civilization. And it made him think there must be some plan going on elsewhere, because you don't look at this earth and mankind and see it. I mean, that's just a very, very rough paraphrase. He talked later in life about God working something out. here below. He said that in front of the U.S. Congress, I believe. So he knew God was doing something. He just didn't understand the plan and purpose. But if you don't understand the plan or the purpose, then you're left to, well, conclude as he did. What if God's not doing something? What is the point of this? Where are we headed? We want God out of the picture, and yet God is orchestrating and planning and carrying out this master plan of reproducing himself. If we would just humble ourselves and ask for God to teach us, to show us the way, to guide our steps, it would lead us right into his family. Well, of course, the world as a whole is cut off from God. They have been since the Garden of Eden. They've been cut off from the tree of life, and so they don't have the Spirit of God. They don't have that mind-opening spirit power that comes from God. And that's why we're in darkness, stumbling along in darkness, like it says in the book of Isaiah. No interest in the things of God. No interest in the purpose of God, the plan of God, God's master plan. Verse 13, it says, I have raised him up in righteousness, and I will direct all his ways. He shall build my city, and he shall let go my captives, not for price nor reward, says the Eternal of Hosts. God will direct all of your ways if you'll let him. But do human beings really believe this? Do they really look to this God? Do they trust him? Do they see the Bible as his instruction manual? No, they reject it. Why? Because the human heart, it's deceitful. It's hostile to the law of God. We need to humble ourselves first and foremost. Turn to God in repentance. And then look at what God will do. Back to Proverbs 16, it says here, verse 16, how much better is it to get wisdom than gold, to get understanding rather to be chosen than silver. How much better is wisdom than gold, God says. The highway of the upright is to depart from evil. He that keeps his way preserves his soul. Pride goes before destruction. That's verse 18. And an haughty spirit before a fall. That comes right out of the word of God. Pride before the destruction. Verse 19, better it is to be of a humble spirit with the lowly than to divide the spoil with the proud. God hates pride. He hates vanity. He hates arrogance. We can't draw close to God if we're filled with pride, if we insist that our way is the right way. We have to be teachable. We have to be malleable. God's the master potter. Verse 21, it says, the wise in heart shall be called prudent, and the sweetness of the lips increases learning. Understanding is a wellspring of life unto him that has it, but the instruction of fools, it says, is folly. Verse 23, the heart of the wise teaches his mouth and adds learning his lips. Pleasant words are as a honeycomb, sweet to the soul and health to the bones. See, all this comes from God and his instructions, this way of life. The other way, verse 25, man's way, the way of the human heart, the deceitful heart. There's a way that seems right unto a man, but the end thereof are the ways of death. Mr. Armstrong in Mystery of the Ages, he talks about this proverb, how that it's mentioned twice in the book of Proverbs, as I emphasized yesterday. And then Mr. Armstrong writes, God said through Moses, you shall not do, after all the things that we do here this day, every man whatsoever is right in his own eyes. That's Deuteronomy 12 and verse 8. And then he gives similar instruction later on in that chapter. Mr. Armstrong says, today, the professing Christian world rejects God's holy days. Holy to him, but which a deceived Christianity hates. They observe instead pagan days that God hates, he goes on to say. It says, many know and confess that these are pagan, talking about the popular holidays of today. They know they're pagan, but they argue, we don't observe these in worshiping the pagan gods. We use their customs in worshiping Christ and the true God. We use it for holy uses and purposes. It seems right. He says, that's the way that seems right to people. They may not mean any wrong. They're deceived. It says, a deceived man doesn't know he's wrong. He thinks he's right. He may be as sincere as those who have found God's way and obey it. Yet God says he will not accept that kind of observance or worship. It's an abomination to him, which he hates. The way that seems right leads to a lot of destruction and death. God's way, however, leads straight into his kingdom, his ruling family. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to submit some feedback, you can email us, td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.